Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mo Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. John Nelson produced today's program. We've just kicked off our fall pledge drive. If you enjoy listening to the Old Mo or any of the other informative programs which will be found on KBOO, please consider making a donation. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. You can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Today on our program, Bill Resnick talked to Kern Kennedy, the Deputy Director of Legislative and Administrative Advocacy at the Sierra Club. Bill and Kern discussed Biden's early environmental initiatives and budget proposals. We conclude our program today with a Left on the Law segment. Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talk about a new Texas law. You know the one I mean. But first up on our program today, Desiree Hellinger speaks with Kendall, movement photographer, professor, and organizer with Portland Buddhist Peace Fellowship, about the life and death of her daughter, Palusa Clementina Mofana Kendall Mofoken, likely of COVID amid riots in South Africa, spurred in part by the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma, but more broadly by widespread desperation, hunger, and inequality amid the COVID lockdown. They also take a moment to honor a 30-year-old South African anti-apartheid freedom fighter who was tortured to death in September 16, 1977.
From watching and reading American mainstream media over the past 10 days, you'd hardly guess that 9/11 marked not just the 20th anniversary of the bombing of the World Trade Center, but also the 48th anniversary of the U.S.-supported coup in Chile that overthrew the democratically elected socialist president Salvador Allende and installed the fascist dictator Augusto Pinochet, unleashing a bloodbath against Chile's left and executing and torturing the folk singer Victor Jara. But September 12th of this past week also marked the 44th anniversary of the murder of 30-year-old South African anti-apartheid freedom fighter Stephen Biko, who was tortured to death by an apartheid regime of racial and economic separation that U.S.-based corporations actively profited from and that the U.S. government propped up for decades. In South Africa, the African National Congress, or ANC, led the resistance, which found international support among labor unions, NGOs, and grassroots organizations, and college students across the world and in the United States, organizing solidarity actions and boycotts. The 1994 election of Nelson Mandela, after decades of struggle, was heralded as the end of apartheid and the beginning of majority rule. As central as some of this history was on college campuses in the U.S. as it was unfolding, and as involved as so many labor unions were in solidarity work at the time, there seems to be far less solidarity work with South Africa today, though in many ways material conditions for Black South Africans are as bad today, if not worse, than they were before apartheid was, at least in theory, officially dismantled. But the fact that the economic conditions for the vast majority of Black people in South Africa remains unchanged highlights a longstanding critical debate between the African National Congress and the Black Consciousness Movement, of which Biko was a primary intellectual architect. While the ANC defined apartheid in strictly racial terms, the Black Consciousness Movement, as Hador Eid and Andy Clarno, among others, have noted, quote, Black radicals insisted that the struggle should simultaneously confront the state and the racist capitalist system. Unless racism and capitalism were confronted together, they predicted, post-apartheid South Africa would remain divided and unequal, unquote. The debate also has direct relevance for Palestinian solidarity organizing and the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in response to the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. Today in South Africa, the top 0.01% owns a higher share of wealth than the bottom 90%, and Black people who inhabit the country's informal or makeshift settlements are disproportionately impacted by lack of access to COVID vaccinations that generate wealth for a tiny global elite. The reality of the limits of liberation in contemporary South Africa was brought home to some of us in Portland's social justice community with the death in July of Palesa Clementina Mofana Kendall Mofokeng, who died on July 18th of COVID in the midst of widespread riots. Palesa's adoptive mother, known by the single name Kendall, is a well-loved member of the Portland activist community, a perennial presence at Portland Street Actions as a photographer and as an organizer with the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, along with any number of other local groups. They have an MA in English, a PhD in theater. They were a full professor at Smith College before they took a Fulbright to Lesotho before moving to South Africa, where their life and Palesa became inextricably woven together. They met in 1992, the year Palesa turned 7, and 4 years after Nelson Mandela was released after nearly 30 years in prison. If you want to get a sense of the kind of poverty that Palesa was born into, you might search up the Playing for Change re-release of Peter Gabriel's 1987 song, Biko. The video is haunting and beautiful. Peter Gabriel, Angelique Kidjo, and Yo-Yo Ma perform, at least virtually, alongside a global ensemble of musicians, singers, and dancers that ranges from Cape Town, South Africa, to Mumbai, to L.A., Taiko drummers in Little Tokyo, California, perform alongside drummers and dancers from the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe in Nevada. Collectively, they pay tribute to Biko and to the living promise of decolonizing struggles that are inherently and necessarily anti-capitalist, given that the history of capitalism is inextricably rooted in colonial and neocolonial violence. The video opens with the all-Black Cape Town ensemble singing amid the rubble of an impoverished informal settlement in Guguletu, which, as Kendall noted, looked very much like the settlement where she first encountered Palesa.
Port Elizabeth weather fine. It was business as usual in police room 619. Oh, Biko, 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 Biko.
Business as usual for Palesa's mother, without access to land or other means of production, meant being driven to the brink as an impoverished sex worker with 7 children and no access to reproductive or any other kind of health care. Palesa would go on to become a healer, who, given a choice between the relative luxury of the United States or the settlements of South Africa, would choose South Africa. Amid riots spurred by hunger and desperation exacerbated by the COVID lockdown, and following the arrest of former President Jacob Zuma, Palesa died on July 18th in South Africa, leaving behind 2 children, one 15 and the other just days short of their first birthday. Kendall, speaking about Palesa.
She was a large, joyful, loud spirit. She was very extroverted and loved to be with people and to connect. And she just was a walking party. She was joy. She was a loud, joyful, huge presence in the world. When she walked in, everybody knew she had walked into the room. But she was born to an impoverished alcoholic sex worker who did not want her. She became a kind of waif. So when I went to Lesotho in 1992 as a Fulbright scholar, I went into the village to start meeting the people. And I noticed this little girl who was always on the margins. And I asked about her and people said, oh, she's trouble. Don't ask. But then she came to me. She took my hand. She looked into my face and she just grabbed hold and held on. The first year that I was there, I started sending her to school because she had never been to school. I bought her underwear and clothing and shoes. And I did that for a number of children. It wasn't just her, because for what an American would spend for lunch, you can send a child to school for a year. So of course I did that. But the second year I was there, she developed a very high fever and she became unconscious. And her actual birth mother brought her to my door and said, you bury this one, God wants her to die. So of course I took her to the hospital. She had typhoid, they treated her. And when I got her out of the hospital, her mother, she said, I'm not taking her back. And Palesa fell on the ground crying, sobbing. And I felt that rejection by her mother so powerfully that I just took her to my house. And I did a lot of work to set her up in a boarding school. And I thought, okay, I'll just pay and I'll go back to America and I'll send money. But during the second year that I was there, when she came home for Easter vacation, she freed a child who had been used for sex, an 8-year-old child who was tied to a bed by her leg. Palesa, being deeply empathetic, cut her loose, brought her to me and said, you take care of her too. So again, I did all I could do with the social work people and there was no space in an orphanage. I finally put the second one in the same boarding school. And after a few months, the nuns told me she's going to die. The little one is so traumatized by what her life has been. So I thought, well, what the hell have I got to do with my life that matters more than this? So I took her and I started procedures to adopt her. And then I thought, well, why not Palesa too? So, well, she had a little sister who she was very bonded with, who she carried on her back. And I said, what about her? And her mother said, I'm keeping her. She's my baby. So I took Palesa and I feared there would be a problem because of the bond she had with her biological sister. But we lived for the next 4 years in South Africa. And those were the 4 years of Nelson Mandela's term as president. He actually had 5 years, but I stayed for four of them. I stayed from 92 to 99. That was when I lived in Southern Africa. And in 95, I cannot tell you how excited everybody was. It was the beginning of the new South Africa. It was the end of despair. It was the beginning of what we thought would be equality and was not, sadly. Neocolonialism took over. There became a governing ruling class of wealthy Black, Indian, and white people all.
So a kind of multiracial capitalism.
Yeah. Yes. And they just repeated the horrible injustices. I don't blame Mandela for this, although he did let the white people off very easily, which is why they made him such a hero. He let all the white people keep their wealth because they just don't get it. White people were entitled to free education from kindergarten through college in schools that had Olympic-sized swimming pools and every possible technological innovation, computers, smart boards, everything. And Black children went to school, if at all, they had to pay, and they went to little shack things with no blackboards and no... The inequality was unimaginable to people in America. I mean, we have horrible, horrible inequality, but this was that on steroids. So she was coming from that kind of background of hunger and despair. And within her class and caste, she was at the bottom because she was an unwanted female child. And yet she had this huge spirit and this beautiful soul. and great empathy. I mean, who else would cut another child loose and bring her? How she died. Okay, so I brought her to America with me in 99. She did not like America. It was so shocking to her that people had to make appointments to talk to each other, that people didn't walk in the streets, that they got into cars to get from place to place. The whole individualistic culture of America to her was just anathema. And she missed her little sister horribly. And she dreamed about her little sister. She heard voices of her little sister calling her. So when she was 18 and grown, she chose to go back. And I supported her after she went back. She couldn't find jobs. Finally, she decided she wanted to be a nurse. So I sent her to school. She became what we would call a licensed vocational nurse or a practical nurse. But she made it all the way through the program, and she was so proud. She was so proud of her uniform and being a nurse and being a healer. And she also trained as a traditional healer. So she was a Sangoma as well as a Western healer. But when COVID came, first she got TB from her patients and was treated, but her lungs were damaged. And then she got COVID, and she got it in June, and she recovered, but she was using breathing equipment. And then she got it again in July, and she could hardly breathe. She sent me voice messages, and there was a whistle in her chest, and you could hear that every breath was labored. So when the Zuma riot started on July 8th, people started burning down grocery stores.
And we're talking about the former president, Jacob Zuma.
Incredibly corrupt. And because of his corruption, he was asked by his party to step down. And then he was jailed on July 8th. And at that point, there were gangs of Zuma followers who had orchestrated raids of roads, which they did by blowing up trucks. When those riots started by the Zuma people, many other desperately hungry, angry people who have just been sitting with the disappointment of the new South Africa for so many years were furious. And they saw some of the Zuma people looting the grocery stores. And so they thought, well, if they're going to loot the grocery stores, I'm not going to have any food. I better go. So gradually, this rolling movement happened of the people who were hungry, who went into the grocery stores, looted them, and then set them on fire. And if you can imagine hardly being able to breathe in a freezing cold winter, when the toxic smoke from the fires entered her little shack where she lived, she could no longer breathe. And she fought for days. She fought to be able to breathe, because she had a baby who was just about to be one, and she'd bought her some beautiful first year birthday presents she wanted to present to her. But the smoke, there was no food. Nobody could get food from the 11th of July till after the 18th when she died. There was no food, there was no medicine, and there was this hideous choking smoke, which we know about from the fires last year, that just poisonous smoke. She wanted a vaccine, but she couldn't get it, even though she was a health worker. Only 3% of the people in her country have vaccines. Well, you know who those are. Those are the people with money. So she died. We did have a GoFundMe. It raised $20,000, which is wonderful. This will enable Palesa's biological sister to take care of the children and herself and her children. But nothing will ever, ever, ever mitigate that incredible loss. Those children had a mother who was a giant. She was diagnosed with a lung infection rather than COVID. And other friends I have in South Africa says, yes, that's what they're calling COVID, because they don't want the COVID numbers to be high. The real culprit is economic inequality, which is worse in South Africa now than it was before Mandela was elected. And we see it everywhere. You know that it's in Portland. It's the people having to live in the street because of the money hoarding that's going on from the millionaires and the billionaires and the trillionaires. And it is that capitalistic poison that has wrecked the climate and is wrecking the lives of millions of people all over the world. And South Africa is at the cutting edge of that. So it's the poison of capitalism that killed her.
That was the voice of Portland Buddhist Peace Fellowship organizer and photographer Kendall. And we've been speaking about her daughter, Palesa Clementina Mofana Kendall Mofo Keng, a traditional healer and healthcare worker who died in South Africa in July. Alongside Palesa, we honor today Stephen Biko, journalist and anti-apartheid freedom fighter. He was tortured to death on September 16, 1977. We've been reflecting today also on the ongoing impacts of colonial and neo-colonial violence in South Africa, the work yet to be done, and the promise and necessity of cross-national decolonizing struggles. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Omo Variety Hour. We're going to play out today with Playing for Change's re-release of Peter Gabriel's 1987 tribute to Stephen Biko.
Keep your distance, please. Stay away from me. Words of love in times like these. I'm gonna be with you 24 hours a day. A lot of people couldn't stand that, but you can. You'll be with me 24 hours a day. What a lucky man. Stay away from me. Wash your hands, but don't touch your face. How do you like that?
That was Randy Newman with a tongue-in-cheek song called Stay Away about social distancing. This is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's Pledge Drive, folks. If you'd like to make a donation, or better yet, become a KBOO member, just go to kbo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. You can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now here's Bill Resnick talking with Karen Kennedy, the Deputy Director of Legislative and Administrative Advocacy at the Sierra Club. That's so obvious, no sore intended, she's on our side. She knows her way around Washington, D.C. and the Congress. Bill and Karen discussed Biden's early environmental initiatives and budget proposals, including $3.5 trillion Build Back Better bill. Immediately following Bill's interview, he'll be back to address the critical question of global warming. Biden may well be leaning toward funding the program of the investor-owned utilities and reject the decentralized system of the Green New Deal in the left. This bill argues would be world historic tragedy because of IOU program will surely fail while the left has some chance of success. This will be immediately followed by Bill sharing further thoughts on issues raised in the interview.
Karen Kennedy, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. Thank you for having me on.
Karen Kennedy is a Deputy Director of Legislative and Administrative Advocacy at the Sierra Club, and she knows her way around Washington, D.C. and the Congress. She's also an opinion contributor to The Hill, a newspaper that covers the federal government. It's quite important in Washington circles. Everybody reads it. Her most recent piece was titled Biden's Budget Tackles Climate Crisis Across Nearly Every Federal Agency. We'll be discussing Biden's early budget proposals. The article was about the early proposals and also his environmental programs as they developed since then and the Build Back Better budget proposal. We'll conclude the interview discussing the struggle now in Congress, including considerable differences between progressive and centrist Democrats, and of course there's Joe Manchin. So Corinne Kennedy, first give us a sense and evaluate Biden's environmental policies and his evolution.
Thanks for asking, Bill. So I want to start off by saying, you know, he campaigned on having a very strong environmental agenda, realizing that, and he has said this, that the environment is important if we're going to protect families and people. And so from day one, from the time he was on the campaign and he released his environmental plan then to what we saw happen in his first 100 days where he worked on getting us back into the Paris Agreement, where he immediately undid many EOs that stopped climate progress, and then where he signed EOs uplifting things like conserving 30% of lands by 2030 and the importance of clean energy and reestablishing aspects of environmental justice that had been taken for granted over the last 4 years. He kind of came out the gate really strong on climate policy. So I wouldn't say that there's an evolution. What I would say is that we have that trajectory, and then within the first 6 months, so after his 90 days, he solidifies it by releasing a federal budget that is a government of the whole approach to climate through its request for agency funding. And then that's culminated with understanding that he needs to get infrastructure done. And what's the best way to deal with infrastructure is by also having investments in climate done while fixing our roads and bridges. And I think the pandemic has really expressed the necessary need that infrastructure is greater than just roads and bridges. And I think that natural disasters have proven that we need these key investments now that take climate into account in order to be able to both address the climate crisis and properly deal with the needs of those who are going to be the most impacted and those who are looking for jobs. So why not have them centered around climate?
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Hour on KABU Radio, Portland, Oregon, talking to Kieran Kennedy, the Deputy Director of Legislative and Administrative Advocacy at the Sierra Club. She's a registered lobbyist with the Sierra Club, knows her way around Washington, D.C. and the Congress. We've just discussed the Biden budget, his environmental programs, and the scope of them as they've developed. So, Kieran Kennedy, the goals are enormous, and it's necessary to meet them if we're going to maintain a habitable planet. And the time frames are very short, unfortunately, say the climate scientists, that great strides have to be made within the next 10 years, they said 2 years ago. Time is ticking away. So the needs are great. The ambitions are huge. The question then becomes with regard to Biden's efforts. And certainly there's enormous resources that Biden is trying to put behind climate action. But the proposals are one thing. Getting them enacted, as you pointed out, that's something else. So tell us about the various battles now on Capitol Hill.
You know, Bill, right now on Capitol Hill, we are in a once-in-a-generation opportunity to really affect not just investments in climate, but creating family-sustaining wage jobs, right? Making sure children have access to universal pre-K, making sure that everybody has access to broadband internet, just so many things. And so that's what Build Back Better is about. I mean, it's like literally the epitome of the framework that the president ran off of. And, you know, when he came in the office, he did two bills, one not in reconciliation, the other one during reconciliation to deal with COVID. And now this is the opportunity to address all the other things that are super, super necessary. And we're also saying like the breeding of a civilian conservation or climate corps, right, which would provide hundreds of thousands of jobs to folks through the Corps network to be able to work on climate and do some really cool resiliency work within their communities. And we're not talking about the old adage of green jobs, everyone will have a green job. We're talking about real jobs already created that do things like road maintenance, trail rehabilitation, wildlife conservation. That's just to name a few. And that's for folks who are connected to more rural areas. Then there's work like that also internally in the more interior urban areas, like replanting trees in urban areas to help decrease the urban heat island effect and help with water filtration and flood mitigation. Like all of those things are super important, but it's got an uphill battle. And I'll explain to you this uphill battle. In the House, everyone is aligned with the idea that we need $3.5 trillion to get this done. The argument or the fight is over how we pay for it and or making sure that it happens. And so what we saw happen was in the Senate, the Republicans and Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema wanted to do a smaller package that dealt with just the crumbling infrastructure in our country, which is fine. They created the bipartisan infrastructure package for that. That passed the Senate and is currently sitting in the House. And so the fight that we have right now is what progressives are saying is we have no problem funding the $1 trillion for roads and bridges. But we don't want to fund that and not fund the critical infrastructure needs we have while dealing with climate. And those were all the things that dropped out of that bipartisan deal. And so progressives are saying, hey, once you vote on the reconciliation bill, which is Build Back Better, we are happy to go ahead and vote for the bipartisan infrastructure deal. And then the moderates in the House are like, okay, that's great. The 3.5 makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. So how are we going to pay for it? And the pay fors are something that Senator Manchin has also talked about as being important. And so they're doing a dance. The House is definitely set to, all things looking forward, to vote on the infrastructure package within the next 2 weeks and then send it over to the Senate, and then it'll be in the Senate's court. If the Senate can pass that bill, then the House will go ahead and immediately follow up and pass the bipartisan infrastructure deal. And the thing is that we need both to move forward, because both bills carry much of the needs that we need to get things done in this country. And we only have this opportunity, this year, this time to do that. So that's the tension. The tension is progressives want to make sure we get it done, and the moderates are not necessarily in the same place. They would be okay with just the bipartisan deal in many cases, but we can't tackle climate with just the bipartisan deal. We need Build Back Better.
This is KABU Radio, me, Bill Resnick, talking to Kieran Kennedy, the Deputy Director of Legislative Administrative Advocacy at Sierra Club. Kieran, I hope next time we can go deeper into the differences between the progressives and the moderate Democrats and Republicans. Kieran Kennedy, thank you. Keep up the good work, and we can talk again.
Thank you so much, Bill. It was lovely being on your show today.
Hi, folks, our cable listeners and members, and all of you folks who say, yes, I should contribute to that feisty, countercultural, democratically run leftist radio station. Now's the time to do it. So you listeners have just heard me, Bill Resnick, interviewing Corinne Kennedy, who is deputy chief of the Sierra Club's advisory unit on her lobbying, which strongly supports enactment by Congress of the Biden administration's Build Back Better plan and their House budget proposals. In fact, I support them, too. Biden has been a super surprise on matters of the economy and social welfare. His $3.5 trillion package is a wish list of left liberal priorities, money for universal pre-K, for universal access to high-speed broadband, for a civic conservation corps, for dental care for children, for public health agencies, lead paint abatement, all worthy, needed, doable. Anybody who wants to lift the burden of overwork, precariousness, and anxiety from much of this country's working class would support them too. This can be done, and the package supported, but the inequality and downward spiral for so many is not the only crisis facing the Biden administration. Another grave list of looms, even larger, that issue, what to do about climate change and the future of humanity. It's surely the greatest test of the Biden administration. That's because climate science gives us 10 years to begin reducing greenhouse gas emissions, warning that if we fail in this, a process of continuous warming will take hold that's irresistible, irreversible, such that no matter what we do, the warming will continue and ultimately will leave us as toast. Our planet could become uninhabitable for humans, as has happened already in parts of Africa, the Middle East, and China, and the U.S. Southeast is on the way to that list. In this life-or-death issue, the Biden program, its proposals, they're all over the place, because two forces with fundamentally different strategies are contesting them, and the battle is now fierce. They're fighting for the authority and monies to now stop accelerating climate change. Here's how the New York Times describes this struggle. The nation is facing once-in-a-generation choices about how energy ought to be delivered to homes, businesses, and electric cars, decisions that could shape the course of climate change and determine how the United States copes with wildfires, heat waves, and other extreme weather linked to global warming. The Times goes on. On one side, large electric utilities and President Biden want to build the thousands of miles of power lines to move electricity created by distant wind turbines and solar farms to cities and suburbs. The Times acknowledges such integration would strengthen the control that the utility industry and Wall Street have over the grid. Indeed, have over our whole economy, I might add. The Times then describes the other side, that many environmental organizations and community groups, Biden's allies on most issues, are pushing for greater investment in rooftop solar panels, batteries, local wind turbines. They argue that solar panels, batteries, and all other local energy sources should be emphasized because they would be more resilient and could be built more quickly. Amen. But this point in the Times is understated. The entirety of the corporate program, not just the big grid, but also carbon capture and sequestration, safe, they say, nuclear power, oh boy, and geoengineering, all of it exists only on the drawing board. It's inherently unsafe, all of them, and cannot be proven safe and durable. Even the conduits, the wires, or the super high voltage grids cannot be guaranteed as to durability because they have not yet been built. Let me note the obvious. This community system, confederated with other communities in the region, would not need a fabulous, expensive, continent-spanning grid, for they produce the power near the point of use. All of the elements of the local system have been shown to have high durability. They use off-the-shelf technology, ordinary but highly sophisticated and developed wind turbines and especially solar panels. They can be built, and the installations can be built and quickly repaired by any hometown contractor and the millions of their workers across the United States. Any contractor who can build a kitchen or addition to a house can put up a relatively large solar installation. We need to build the electricity transmission and distribution system for the grid of the future and not that of the past. That was said by Howard Lerner, Executive Director of the Environmental Law and Policy Center. Solar energy plus storage is transformative to the electric system, the electric sector, as wireless services were to the telecommunications sector. Unfortunately, say I, no big company, no big business, surely no bank or investor-owned utility will pay this Mr. Lerner any attention or understand if they did in fact read that. They understand that the control of energy is the one sure way that they can retain their overall system of endless growth, all controlled from the top, provide great wealth and power to the few. The fight for decentralized community power confederated across regions can be won. Biden's early proposals, they read like a corporate or a bank or an investor-owned utility dream come true, including the big continent-spanning grid and the safe nukes and the carbon capture. But in the interim, left forces organized and applied pressure. And his Biden's Build Back Better proposal also promises funds for the left's proposed electric system of public centralized networks of confederated cities with electricity generation near the point of use. There are many cities, many in California and across the world, who've already built out the rudiments of a 100% locally produced sun and wind generation system. On particularly good days now, Southern California sun and wind production has satisfied the region's needs for electricity, and the excess is stored or sold to other states. With additional federal monies, we should be able to demonstrate what engineering studies have found, that every region in this country has enough sun and wind potential to make possible the publicly owned, democratically run, resilient sun and wind systems across the country. We can stop climate warming and guarantee a better future. The Biden administration can't be pushed. Everyone who wants to preserve a habitable planet for our children and future generations, they need your join in the struggle. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Strange things have happened that never before. My baby told me I would have to go. Once like I did before, I can't be good, baby, honey, because the world gone wrong. Feel bad this morning, ain't got no home, no use in worrying, cause the world gone wrong. Like I did before, I can't be good, baby, honey, because the world got wrong.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. We conclude our program today with another segment in our Left in the Law series. Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker today discuss the horrific new Texas abortion law. On September 1st, the Supreme Court declined to block one of the country's most restrictive abortion laws, a Texas statute that bans the procedure as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy, which allows civil suits against anyone assisting women about seeking abortions. And they also discussed the political landscape for fighting these aggressive assaults on women and reproductive freedom.
Since the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973, feminist anxieties about overturning Roe have been a persistent worry, but it became an acute fear under the court's current right-wing turn with the Trump appointees. Well, Mike, it seems perversely fitting that Texas, that state where Norma McCorvey, who became Jane Doe in this landmark case, was part of a lawsuit filed in U.S. federal court there against local DA Henry Wade, alleging that the Texas abortion laws were unconstitutional. Now, Texas is again the epicenter over abortion rights, with the Supreme Court adjudicating the fates of so many women. So let's start with this new law in the Lone Star State and the role of the Supreme Court. What's old and what's new in the law, the Texas law itself, that the Supreme Court authorized in what's called a shadow ruling on September 1st?
Well, the takeaway here, Jan, is that Roe v. Wade was born in Texas and it died in Texas. It is dead, is all but the official burial. The Texas law that's new bans all abortions essentially after 6 weeks of pregnancy.
And of course, it has been pointed out that most women don't even know they're pregnant until around 6-7 weeks.
Well, exactly. The first, Roe v. Wade had a clean breakdown of three different trimesters and said that during the first trimester, there's no question that the impregnated host, a woman, has complete autonomy and can do pretty much whatever she wants. And there's the second trimester allowed a little bit of government interference or oversight in some rare conditions. But basically, the question of viability in the third trimester was where the government was allowed to intervene.
Well, the idea being the fetus acquires some different status as it is able to live outside of the woman's body. Of course, viability was always a difficult issue because a fetus can survive, but with major handicaps that are difficult to care for. So there's always this question of what's meant by viability. But at any rate, it established some significant protections for women, but also for doctors who were being prosecuted in these cases before Roe v. Wade.
Well, yeah, viability is always an issue that's going to be litigated because the edge moves this way and that. It's close. But there was never any question about the first trimester until the new Texas law, which essentially got rid of more than half of that time, that 13-week period. So you would think that would be very easy. And when a law is passed, the Supreme Court should have upheld a preliminary injunction to keep it from being enforced until it can be examined. Now, there was a problematic and strange new element, namely the fact that the state tried to evade regulation by charging private citizens with the task of enforcing this law. They made anybody in the world capable of stopping any abortion and gave them lots of money to encourage them to do just that.
Anyone who may be assisting women in their access, attempts to access a service,
friends, family, drivers,
yeah.
I'm talking about people who are allowed to intervene, and that is everybody on the planet. You can be a serial intervener. You can sue 20, 30 people. You get $10,000 a pop. The legislation tried to enroll the entire country, the entire world, in its effort to evade enforcement against government officials. It's a phenomenally huge expansion of the idea of standing, which is a very traditional legal notion that you have to have some direct involvement in a case in order to go to court. Now, that one is complicated. So you've got something complicated and novel, this expansion of who can sue to stop an abortion. And you've got something that's really a clear square shot right at Roe v. Wade, something that just cuts more than half of the trimester in which a woman is allowed to be an autonomous person who can choose to keep the baby or to abort the fetus. what the Supreme Court should have done, and the obvious move, was to issue a stay, because the whole question has not been briefed yet. But they didn't. They threw their hands up in the air and said, well, this is so complicated that we're not going to be able to take it on until it's fully briefed and litigated in lower courts. They focused solely on the complicated new standing question and overlooked entirely the fact that this law essentially ended Roe v. Wade.
So this was, in a sense, a kind of creative, clever move of the anti-abortion movement. And, you know, abortion has always been, when you talk about the heartbeat law, it's always been the heartbeat of the religious right. Conservatives have this fetishistic fixation on this issue and the fetus. And so it, in a sense, we might see this as an attempt to rally the troops in a larger right-wing movement where abortion has become so symbolic for them.
Well, it is clever. It is energetic. It's sharp. It's everything that abortion supporters have not been, because we've been able to rely on the sky gods and sky goddesses who did a really clever thing. And I use the word clever.
You mean the Supreme Court?
That's exactly who I'm talking
about. There's always been this dance around, even with Kavanaugh, you know, and Susan Collins quizzing him and coming before the news at a press conference saying she's convinced that this is standing law and these new Trump appointments are not going to unsettle established law. Well, apparently not.
Well, let's look at where that law came from. Roe v. Wade is based on a case called Griswold v. Connecticut, which is a 1965 case written by William Douglas, the greatest judge of the 20th century. Douglas found what he called a right of privacy in the Constitution. Now, the right of privacy is not specifically mentioned anywhere, but he said it was in the penumbra or shadows of other amendments, like the Fourth Amendment that protects you against unlawful search or seizures. The First Amendment, the freedom of expression, of religion. And he said that the idea of the state barging into a marital bedroom in order to enforce laws that would have banned people from buying contraceptives, which was the law at stake, is anathema to the U.S. and to our Constitution and to the new right of privacy. So the right of privacy was first articulated in Griswold, and then it was the basis of a later case to supporting the right to birth control for unmarried couples from 1972, the Roe v. Wade in 1973, the right to contraception for juveniles in 1977, the right to homosexual relations in 2003, the right to same-sex marriage in 2015. They're all based on one form or another of the right to privacy. But that right is not clearly articulated in the Constitution, and it could be seen, and probably should be seen, as a political notion.
Just to talk about that legal and rhetorical strategy, it's been a two-edged sword in the history of social movements. Throughout much of the late 20th century, liberals made the point, well, homosexuality was okay, and the privacy, it was like don't ask, don't tell during the Clinton administration, the military, what gay people do in the privacy of their own bedrooms is fine, just don't put it in my face. Women have had abortions, terminate pregnancies probably as long as women have been getting pregnant, and doctors have assisted them. It wasn't until there was a mass mobilization of women on the streets that this became such a signature issue of women's emancipation. So was there,
That's right.
Something problematic from the start about using right of privacy as a broad political legal argument, given that a lot of movements face their opposition when they become public out in the streets and fight for something bigger than what they would do in their own private homes or in their own private conversations with their doctors?
I think the right to privacy is very real and is worth protecting and relying on, and it has been relied on for many important decisions. The problem is relying on the court. The problem is thinking that these sky gods and goddesses are not ever going to just fold their tents and walk away, or actually that they will all die off. They are all dead now. We're not dead. We're alive. And we're dealing with a political situation where we've been totally outflanked, the quote right to life movement has been active in every possible way, from just the grossest murders to the most genteel tea sessions and church visits. They've been active at small levels in small towns, at the state level, at the federal level. They've been creative, they've been energetic, and they now have a court that supports them.
Although most Americans, according to public polls, support the right of abortion, certainly for the first trimester, sizable majorities, including Catholics, oppose overturning Roe v. Wade. And,
exactly.
You know, it's kind of interesting. The Supreme Court, these are not like the Republican politicians who are running scared about the wind at their back with the next election coming up. These are lifetime appointees who ideally are protected from the hurricanes generated by the religious right.
It's true. It's one of those issues where most people support the notion of abortion, but it's not a front and center issue. Whereas those who oppose it, many of them are absolutely dedicated. It's what they do in life. So that always creates a skewed situation. They have been targeting the bench, and they've done so very successfully. They now have people who do not believe in Roe v. Wade, who have already essentially eliminated it, and will, the idea of having some formal ceremony in the future is going to be just symbolic, because Roe v. Wade right now is dead.
So given that, we should grieve and mourn appropriately, but then turn out perhaps learning from that history in larger numbers. And how do you see the role of legal strategies in the fight for reproductive justice, which in many ways is stronger by some measures than the pro-choice movement of the 70s and 80s that didn't include things like access to health care, access to child care, not only the right to end a pregnancy, but the right to care for the children we bring into the world. The emphasis on reproductive justice and Black feminist insights to how people of color are particularly affected by access to health care, and through the history of including the oppression within the existing medical system, healthcare system, so that in many ways the movement has broadened and deepened its politics, but there is still this question of how do we mobilize and organize in turning from just pleading our case before the chief justices and turning to the streets or other avenues for fighting back.
Well, you've asked two questions. One is, what are legal remedies? And then you've shown all the ways in which there is now much greater public support, which is true. And legal strategies always follow the public. I mean, legal decisions are, rarely do they ever lead. They're compelled. But there are legal strategies, aside from all the necessary mobilization you're talking about. I think the best one is sort of a jujitsu use of the First Amendment and religious liberty. You may have noticed that religious liberty is the hot item among the present court members. The Supreme Court ruled in a 7-2 decision that actions by a Colorado Civil Rights Commission violated the free exercise clause of the and religious liberty of Jack Phillips, who's a Christian baker who refused to create a cake for a same-sex wedding. They had a 7-2 majority, and Gorsuch wrote a separate concurring opinion, articulating an even stronger defense of religious liberty, pointing out how many hospitals now are allowed to and do in fact make decisions about what to do and what not to do on a religious basis. Justice Thomas wrote a separate concurring opinion defending Jack Phillips' free speech claims under the First Amendment. Well, abortion rights is a First Amendment issue, given that many religions, including Reformed Judaism, fully endorse them, and the ideology opposing such rights is religious-based. Therefore, when you ban legal abortions, the state is endorsing one religion over another, which is unconstitutional. Abortion rights are about women's rights to the same freedoms as men, including the right to enjoy sex, They're about women's freedoms as human beings, as autonomous creatures, as opposed to slaves from a state or a patriarchal control. Calling for the right of abortion is, in the most profound sense, a call for sexual freedom and equality. We need to get away from the fear that constricts us to just defining abortions as health care and take it on squarely as part of a broad worldview that we could call a religion, and certainly would be defined as a religion under the currently operating notion of religious liberty.
So, okay. Well, with that rousing call to the courts and the streets, we'll stop for today, but continue to follow this, because we are going to have to organize to fight back. And I think there's more on our side in many ways, and creative energy around what's called intersectional politics, how the issue of abortion intersects with so many other aspects of people's lives. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the Supreme Court and the new Texas law.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Moral Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. A big thanks to John Nelson, who produced today's program. Also, thanks to all our contributors and guests, Desiree Hellingers and Kendall on the COVID epidemic in South Africa, Bill Resnick and his guest, Karen Kennedy, discussing Biden and the environment, and finally, Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken on the work that must be done to keep abortion safe and legal. It is the KABU Fall Drive, and our theme is The Sounds of Democracy. KABU is a nonprofit organization, and 80% of our funding comes from our members. Won't you become part of that effort by making a donation? Just go to kabu.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. And again, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and the culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well, can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Moles' perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So, tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This is KBOO Portland. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of this show in a day or two on our website at kabu.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at the Old Mole on Twitter.